Reverend Coronado.
Hello, everyone. My name is Reese. I'm an alcoholic.
And
I am happy to be here tonight. However, when I first agreed, I didn't realize that there was a convention going on. And that's okay. We're all here together. And I'm grateful to Randy for asking me to be here to share with you. And I really want to thank Vinny again for his share. I think he was amazing. He actually told my story. There's really no reason for me to be up here. He said it all. Fear and pain. Fear and pain got us here. Fear and pain got me here. I have a lot of beliefs and opinions being an alcoholic, and they're my own. You don't have to agree with them. I also like to share that I did other things besides alcohol, a big part of my story, although I am sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grew up in Seattle, Washington, by a single mother and a brother 3 years my senior. And growing up, now it's funny because a few years ago I was talking to my brother and I was telling him how I felt about our childhood, and it was all gloom and doom and everything was dark and everything was dramatic. And he asked me, are you sure we grew up under the same roof? And I think that's the difference. You know, being an alcoholic, I feel that everything, when I see the world, it's extreme. It's like nails on a chalkboard. My feelings are extreme. My thoughts are extreme. Everything is the glass half empty. It's negative. I lived from a place of negativity. And it started really young. My mother, she suffered from chronic migraines and depression. And so in my mind, and this is my reality, it's my truth, growing up, the house was dark and it was quiet. And we had to be careful not to upset my mother because she would get sick. And I resented her for that. I knew I was screwed already because I was a girl. Here was my example, and I thought, this isn't what I want. I don't want to be like this. So here I had this brother who was strong, and he was tough, and I wanted to be just like him. And, of course, older brothers, as I'm sure there's a few out here, you treat your siblings like, well, my brother treated me like a younger sibling. He told me I was dumb and stupid, and I was never going to be as smart as him or as fast as him or as tough as him. And, of course, good little budding alcoholic that I am, I went to prove him wrong. I had to prove him wrong. But in the back of my head, I believed him. I'm stupid. I'm not good enough. My mom, look at her. I don't want to be a girl. So that started really, really young. By the time I'm 9 years old, I am the biggest tomboy. I am more a boy than my brother. Big time tomboy. And my mother one day, she announced out of the blue that we are going to live with my father in Irvine, California. Now, I had only seen my father a couple times over the years. He's old school Latino, and I'm hardcore tomboy. And like I said, I didn't really know him that well, and I didn't know Irvine, California at all. We moved in with him, and right away we had a conflict. He wanted me to wear dresses. He wanted me to be feminine. He wanted me to be quiet, and I was none of that. And I wanted his love, but I didn't know how else to be. This is who I was. And again, there was one more conflict in my life. I'm not acceptable because I'm a tomboy. My dad's never going to accept me. I'm not okay. And I was keeping score in my mind of just how not okay I was. I'm 9 years old. We're living in Irvine. Here's the other problem we had. During this time, we were the only mixed family in the neighborhood. Now, I'd never thought of myself in terms of race before. This time, it was all white people, and that sounds funny to say. And all of a sudden, I was being called names, and I didn't understand. And pretty quickly, I started not liking white people, and I just didn't understand why does life have to be so hard? You know, I'm 9, 10, 11, 12, and life was hard. I didn't fit in anywhere. The voices in my head were going off. And they wanted me to be miserable. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember someone sharing with me, yeah, there's a part of you that wants you dead. And it was so profound when I heard that. And I agree, but it's like how weird that a part of our psyche wants us dead, wants us miserable. So here I am. I'm 12, 13 years old, one day out of the blue, it's kind of like your family. My mom announces that we're moving back to Seattle without my father. And, you know, my brother and I, we were to and fro. We were taken here, taken there, without any explanation, no conversation. And it's really unnerving when you're a child and you don't know what's going to happen next. Where am I going to end up? And so we move back to Seattle. And I'm angry. I'm 13. Got puberty going on, hormonal. My dad's not there. I don't know what's going on. Nobody's talking to me. My mom goes into depression. My brother goes into depression. Here I am. Who do I talk to? I didn't want to upset mom because she'll get sick. She was already sick. And I was a mess. And so the place my mom could afford was in the south end of Seattle. Now, the south end of Seattle is predominantly Black and Asian. Right away, I'd be walking to school, and I was called Goldilocks and White Girl. And here I, you know, I don't fit in. There is nowhere where I fit in. And I hated everyone. I hated the world. I hated me. I hated you. I hated my family for being so screwed up. And I don't know how it happened. One day I discovered anger. I discovered anger. Came from nowhere, and it hit me like a Mack truck. I went into a rage. And it was the most powerful feeling I had ever felt. I like to say that was my first drink. It was my first escape. And I drowned myself in rage. I hit my mother. I tore apart the house. I got in fistfights with my brother. I mean, I was a lunatic and so enthralled by that feeling of, I just don't care. I don't care how you feel. I don't care how I feel. For a moment, those voices would shut up. And I felt okay. I felt powerful. By the time I'm about 15, I discover my second drink, which is love. I fell in love for the first time. And he was mixed like I was. So I thought, maybe this is where I fit in. He's Creole. And he came from, you know, a real mixed kind of lifestyle and different cultures. And I thought, this is cool, you know. Within the first few months, I started running away from home. And I was so in love, you know, and pretty soon I end up moving out. I move out. My mom says it was 15, I don't know, 15, 16. I move in with Mr. Santos, and we end up fighting. And I knew this before we moved in together. It was very physical. We fought a lot, and I just felt it was a part of life. I grew up like that with my brother. You know, we're very physical, and I just felt, well, I know my brother loves me, so he must love me. Just kind of the way it is. I didn't have anything else to gauge my life on. And so we were together 4 years. And towards the end of that time, now mind you, I'm in school. Nobody knows about the dark part of my mind in school. I'm vice president of the drill team in high school. I'm on swim team. I am teacher's aide in math. I'm in the special choir. I'm in the drama club. I'm in all this stuff. And I love school. I'm a straight A student. But nobody knows who I am, and I don't let anybody in. I didn't have a lot of friends because I really felt like if you knew who I was, you wouldn't like me. And because I didn't like me, so I had to excel in school. Anyway, so after I moved out, I continued going to school. I graduated. Not long after that, I left Mr. Santos, and I was a mess. I was a mess. You know, I had started going to the hospital, you know, black eyes, different things went on, and I didn't know where to turn. The voices were loud. You're a loser. There's nowhere you're going to feel safe. There's nowhere where you're going to feel good about yourself. And I need to tell you that at 15, I had tried to commit suicide for the first time because I just felt like life wasn't worth living. And when it didn't work out, I can't even commit suicide. And I can remember, you know, I was an asthmatic as a child. And when I waited till everyone went to sleep, I went under the bathroom sink. I ingested every medication that I had. Very calm. There was relief in the thought that I won't wake up in the morning. And when I went to bed, I was totally at peace, probably for the first time in my life. And then when I woke up a few hours later, deathly sick, hallucinating, it was awful. And so the next day, I just simply told my mom that I didn't feel well. I didn't tell her about that because I felt like a loser. And, So here I am, I'm 19, I'd left Brad Santos. And I'm raging. I'm a raging alcoholic, you guys, without a drink. My brother I had seen in high school, he drank and smoked weed and did other things. And I used to tell him, you look like such an idiot when you're high. How could you do that? And I knew my dad was an alcoholic, even though I don't remember a whole lot of that time, but my mom had told me he was an alcoholic. So I told myself I was never going to drink. By the time I'm 19, I really need a drink. I need a drink. So I'm stumbling around, and I don't know what to do with myself. And I, of course, I run into Smiley. And Smiley was my second love. And Smiley, he was a cholo. And he talked like this. And pretty soon I was talking like this, too. We were part of this lowrider gang. You know, I felt really cool. I'm like, he's Chicano. I'm Chicana. Maybe this is where I fit in. And so for a while, it was okay. And pretty soon, I realized that him and his friends kept really odd hours. When I was going to sleep, they were just getting started. They were getting their day started. And I was pretty naive about drugs and about different things like that. And I remember one night we were all at this club and his best friend's girlfriend, we went in the bathroom and she said, you really have to try this. She said, if you try this, you're going to dance better, you're going to feel better, it's just life is going to be better. And then I tried it and it was Coke. And I tell you what, the voices stopped. Immediately, the voices were gone. And I loved it. And I started drinking along with pretty quick. I mean, it happened pretty fast. And I realized the more I drank, the more I used, the more I didn't give a shit about you, what you felt, what you thought, what I did. I wasn't thinking or feeling anything. It was one party. After 2 years, I pretty much bottomed out and I blamed it on Smiley. It's all your fault. I'm all screwed up. That's what we do, right? We blame everyone else. Take absolutely no responsibility for my own actions. So I leave Smiley and I'm a wreck. I move back in with my mom. I start going to college. And in college, I'm looking for something to fill the void. I'm looking for something to make me feel okay. I didn't know this at the time, but I just wanted to feel okay. I wanted the voices to stop. I wanted to quit feeling like crap. And so, you know, there was Elliot, the preppy white boy. And then there was Mamoon, the African who smoked spliffs. And I really liked that crowd. They were a lot more mellow than the crowd I had just left. And it was, you know, I was trying different. Maybe if they're completely opposite from the one before, then I'll be okay. Somebody's going to make me okay. Something's got to make me okay. Well, it dawned on me one day. I know what my problem is. It's the men. They're screwing up my life. I'm going to get a girlfriend. And I remember thinking very clearly, duh. That's the answer. I needed a girlfriend. And, you know, good little alcoholic that I am, I find her. I'm in Pike Place Market, downtown Seattle. And she's playing guitar. And she's got this really cool, funky painted hat on. She paints her guitar. She's really good. And she's Eva Ruma from Venezuela. Of course. Of course. We start hanging out. We're having a great time. And pretty soon I realize she's probably the most messed up person that I'd ever been with up until this point. But by this time, I'd stopped going to school. I'd stopped working. My mom had kicked me out of the house. And I was living on the streets of Seattle with Eva Ruma from Venezuela. And, you know, for a while, it was exciting. My mom says I had sent her a couple letters saying that it's just like the movies, it's dangerous, it's edgy, you know. But I don't remember that. You know, the denial is very powerful. Denial will tell you life is great when you're living in the gutter. Denial has a way of masking anything that doesn't serve the disease. And so I'm on the streets. And, you know, I lived on the streets for about 4 years and from Seattle to L.A. and back. And I tell you, during that time, I lost myself more than I'd ever been lost in my life. And the vicious cycle is I had to ingest as many substances as I could to still the voices and still the feelings. And then when I came to and I realized what my life was, I had to ingest the substances to numb myself out, to mask the fact that I was living like an animal. And, you know, and I went all the way down below the curb. And I would beg the winos in the parks for a drink if it was past 2 a.m. and I had nothing, you know, I had nothing. And I picked up cigarette butts out of the gutter. And I slept in parks in the bushes. Sometimes I would sneak like an animal, knowing that I had to fall asleep somewhere where no one would find me, because if I was out, I was out for a couple days because I'd been up for so many, for weeks sometimes. And it was, no one should have to live like that. I'm grateful today that I have this story because it got me to these rooms. I'm one of the extremists. I needed to go through absolutely everything I went through to get here. And there's no more yets. I can remember I was in and out of recovery. I was in and out of jail. I was in and out of the psych wards, in and out of hospitals. I'd been beaten. I'd been raped a bunch of times. You know, all the stuff that happens to us when we're out there happened. And somehow I still have some semblance of sanity today. It's a miracle. You know, I am a miracle. We are all miracles if we're sober sitting in this room today. I can remember in the end, and it's, I'm in an alley, and I have my old, this is going to tell you the kind of drunk I was. My old English 800, my Newport cigarettes, and my crack pipe. And I have them lined up. And I'm in the alley behind in some docking area, something, and I'm sobbing, and I'm sobbing. And I'm thinking, I'm going to drink this, I'm going to hit this, and I'm not going to be able to escape. Because that's where it took me. I was no longer able to escape the feelings and the thoughts about myself, about my life. It was like as soon as I started ingesting these substances, I was right there in living color. I could not get away from myself. And that's all I'd ever wanted, was to be so far away from me that I didn't give a damn. And here I was doing all this stuff, and I couldn't escape any longer. And, you know, today I realize that that's the best thing that could have happened to me. At the time, it was the worst, most desperate place I had ever been in my life. Just, I couldn't get away. And there I am, and, you know, and I have my baggy jeans on. I have my combat boots. I have my baseball hat on backwards because I'm still the tomboy. You know, when I'm out there, I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I will do anything it takes to get and stay loaded. You know, I hung with the little gangs and I did, you know, all that stuff. It's so funny when I think about it now because I look in the mirror and I'm like, really? Really? That was me? So I'm in that alley and all this is going on, you know, and it took a little while longer. A series of events happened where I called my mom one day. My mom had shut the door and locked it on me long before. Best thing she could have done, because I would just use her. You know, at first she'd let me come back and I'd go eat all her food, sleep for a few days, and I'd be gone again. It was too much pain for her, so she just simply shut the door. And she said, if you ever want to get sober, call me and I will get you in a recovery home. So that day came again. You know, I'd been in many recovery homes, but nothing had ever, I judged you. You know, I said, I'm not like you. I'm different. I'm smarter than you. I know more than you. There's a way to drink and use successfully. I just haven't found it yet, but damn it, I'm going to find it. And I would plot as I'm in the recovery home how I was going to be successful next time. And I couldn't hear a word. Of course, you know, it was very humbling when I realized I'd done all the yets and probably added a few of my own. So I called my mother, and she came right over, and she got me in another recovery home. And, you know, I was there for a couple months, and I decided I needed to leave the state because the guy I had actually gone into the recovery home to escape, okay, I'm being honest here, I didn't go into recovery this last time exactly to be sober. It was to escape someone because I'd smoked all his drugs. And I knew he wouldn't look for me there. So that's where I went. I went to that recovery home, and while I was there, something happened. I don't know exactly what, but I knew I needed to leave the state if I wanted to stay sober. So they said, oh, Palm Springs, California. I hear they have great recovery there. And you know me, I'm thinking Palm Springs, like movie stars, and it's glamorous. And obviously I was very naive. Went to Palm Springs. It was, I think, mid-August. And now, mind you, I'm cool. I am so cool. I'm on the plane. At this time, there was no terminal attached to the aircraft. So there was this long stretch of pavement, and I got my baggy jeans on, my baseball hat. I have my army duffel bag with everything that I own in and on my back. And I'm trying to be cool walking across the pavement, and I'm telling you, the pavement was undulating. It was moving. I knew I was sober, but I'd never been in 120-degree weather before. And I'm thinking, okay, Reese, you've finally done it. You've made it to hell. Sober! So there I am, you know, and I'm pissed and I'm sweating. There's someone at the airport to meet me, and we're going up to Desert Hot Springs, just the other side of hell. We're driving up there and tumbleweeds are going, and I'm like, where am I? Within a week, my mom had paid for a month at the sober living, and within a week, I'd broken all the rules because I figured my mom paid, I'm sober, I should be able to do whatever I want. I am not following any rules. Yeah, and so they kicked me out. I'm like, you're kicking me out, but my mother paid. You break the rules, you leave. So I'm walking down Desert Hot Springs with my duffel bag. I have nowhere to go, and I'm pissed. I'm sober, and I had just found out within that week that I was pregnant with the child that the guy I was trying to leave. Yeah, you get it? The one I escaped in Seattle, I'm pregnant with his child. I'm pissed. I had $100 in my pocket. And this is when interesting things started to happen. For the first time, and I don't know how many years, that $100 did not translate to how many bottles of alcohol, how much. It didn't do that. It stayed $100 in my pocket. And the other weird thing that happened is it dawned on me, you know, when you're in trouble, you should go to a meeting. I never would have done that before. So I went and I found a meeting in, I can't remember the name of the area now, Cathedral City. So I was at this meeting in Cathedral City, and I'm pissed, and I'm sweating, and I'm sitting there, and I'm so angry. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. I didn't want to be loaded, but I didn't know what I was going to do with myself, and something happened. All of a sudden, this happened. I didn't raise my own hand. I don't know what happened, and I started sharing. And I started telling you guys what was going on. I started crying. I couldn't believe it. It was like I was looking at me from out here, you know, like, what are you doing? As soon as I was done, I was mortified. I got up, I went outside, and I sat down, and I'm thinking, you idiot, these people are going to think you're so stupid. You know, the voices were loud and clear in my head telling me what a loser I was. Well, after the meeting, you guys know what you do. You came out, you see me, thanks for sharing, and you're so wonderful, and keep coming back, and we love you. And you know, in the past, if you would have said that, I would have said, yeah, a lot of things, but probably not what came out of my mouth at this point, which was, thank you, and I believed you. God was there that day. God was all over me that day, and He let my heart be open enough to hear and believe what you had to tell me. I related with you. I felt connected with you for other people for the first time in my life, and I don't know why. So this woman there said that there was a recovery home in India and that accepted pregnant women. So I went into this recovery home, and you know, I had nowhere else to go. All I knew was I wanted to stay sober. I wasn't necessarily willing to follow many directions, but I didn't want to be loaded anymore. And so I was in this house, and I was angry, and I'm tough, and no one can tell me what to do, and my water breaks at 6 months. And my daughter was born at 25 weeks, and she was 1 pound, 7 ounces. And I had to be rushed to Loma Linda to have her. And it was interesting because she was in the hospital for many months. And the director of the recovery home, Danny Leahy, would drive me up there a couple times a week and say he was his grandpa so he could get in there with me and see the baby. And I had so many mixed emotions going on at this time. I see this little tiny being attached to all these tubes and wires to these machines, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do with her? I don't even know how to take care of myself. I don't know who I am. How am I supposed to take care of this little, tiny, precious being? So I had mixed feelings. Part of me wanted God to take her home, and part of me wanted her to live, but it was pretty balanced. I was scared to death. So time's going on. I'm in this recovery home. My behavior's not changing a whole lot. Now, mind you, I'm working the steps. I'm doing the best that I can at this point, but it's not good enough. I'm threatening residents. The last straw for the director was I chased this girl back to her room, threatening her. I don't know what I was threatening her. And he kicked me out. And I can remember going to his office, and I asked him, do you think I can stay sober? And that, for whatever reason, it meant so much to me what he thought. And he said yes. And that's all I needed. So I took off for a while, and I made a couple stops in different people's houses, and I got my baby back. And Danny Leahy let me go back to the recovery home and stay there for a couple weeks before I went to Seattle to visit my family with this new little baby. And you know, it's been quite the journey. I got sober June 15th, 1992. I'll be 17 this year. Whoa, it's so weird, you know. I have a 16-year-old daughter who's never seen me loaded. She's seen me crazy, but she's never seen me loaded. And those early years were really tough. You know, I really dove into the steps. When I got my baby back, I wanted to change desperately. And I didn't know how. I didn't know how to be a woman. I didn't know how to be a lady. I didn't even know what size I was because everything I wore was like 3 sizes too big. You know, I was lost. I was lost in recovery for a long time. I just, I did what you people told me, that you go to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings in those first 10 years. A lot of meetings. I had a sponsor. I believed in what my sponsor told me. I had sponsees. I helped other people through the steps. And she said, you know, if you have me on one side and them on the other, you'll be safe in the middle. And because, you know, when we hang out on the fringes, the disease picks us off. I've seen it happen so many times. So there I am, you know, and I'm like, what am I going to do with my life? I'm on welfare. I have no legal skills. So I have this little baby, and I had to stay home with her because she was so sickly in the first years. And not long after that, I went to beauty school. The decision was, you know, maybe they'll teach me how to be a lady in beauty school. So I went to beauty school, and it was a bunch of tough little ghetto chicks, you know, and I don't know how I managed to not get in a fight and not show them who the tough chick was, but I did. I carried myself with grace and dignity to the best of my ability, as far as I remember, through that year of this school, and I graduated, and I went, and I got my license, and it was the most amazing day of my life. I started working for the first time, and I was being self-supporting. You know, I had this little child. I had my meetings. I had recovery. I had you. You guys walked me through everything. In those first years when I was on welfare, I had nothing. I remember my mom, the only thing of value I had was this espresso machine that my mom had sent me. You people brought a tin can to my house after meetings, and I would make lattes, and you would put donations in my can. I'll never forget that. You guys were with me through everything, through my daughter's birthdays, through the heartaches, through the love relationships. You know, I did the same thing in sobriety that I did when I picked, you know, maybe this person will fix me. Maybe this person. I still have that mentality. I still do to a degree. You know, today I'm okay with me. The voices aren't nearly as loud. And I am very solution-oriented. It's all about what can I do to make myself feel better today. And it's not picking up a drink. It's praying. It's working with a newcomer. It's going to a meeting. It's going to work. It's carrying myself with dignity. It's all those things that I had no toolbox before I got here. I got it from you. So I started working, and within 3 years, I became an independent contractor. I started working for myself. You know, I started getting the nicer cars and the better place to live and some new things. I learned what size I was. Guys are not alive enough here. And, you know, life was starting to get really good. You know, I was playing catch up, though. For those first years after I got a job, I wanted to be, you know, like the Joneses. You know, so pretty quickly it became about what was, as long as I looked good on the outside, I was comparing myself to your outsides. And I went through that period, and I quickly learned that wasn't the case. I started being attracted to the quiet ones in the room. You know, the quiet sobriety, the ones who had a lot of time, but they weren't showy, and they were. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to learn how to not be the center of attention, how to be one of many and be okay with myself. And I started working on that. And, you know, I fell in love with someone, and I moved out to San Diego almost 8 years ago. We got married. The director of that recovery home gave me away. It was really interesting. My daughter was a flower girl. And that marriage was all sobriety. Hundreds of people who were sober. It was the most amazing experience. It didn't work out. A year later, I moved out. But we're still friends today. And, you know, he's got almost 11 years sober today. So what a blessing. My life today is pretty simple. I go to meetings. I need to tell myself here. I've gotten pretty complacent over the past few years in my sobriety. When I first moved to San Diego, I started a women's meeting. And I had it for 7 years. And I became very close with a bunch of women. We're called Women on a Mission. And we went to retreats together. We went to out-of-town meetings together. And we were very proud to stand, you know, as Women on a Mission, our group. And when I moved to Imperial Beach in December, and I gave up that meeting. And it's been kind of roving. It's been in different places, and I haven't been. I'm a student. I'm in school again. I'm a four-point student, I'm proud to say. And, you know, I want to be a photojournalist one day. I've written a book about my life. I haven't published it yet, but that will happen. I have a lot of ambition, a lot of goals. And because I'm sober, I know that I can achieve them. Life has gotten so big. Before I got here, everything, tunnel vision, it was all about how I was going to stay loaded, maintain being drunk. That's all I cared about. After I was here for a while, anything was possible. Anything is possible if I stay sober. And I have proven to myself, to the people around me, to my daughter. My daughter We have the most amazing relationship you could ever imagine. When she turned 15, 13, 14, I was starting to like, oh my, is she going to be like me? Oh my gosh, is she going to do what I did? No. And it's because I know how to love my child. I give her affection. I love her. I talk to her. We communicate. She has the tools of recovery just like I do. She was raised in these rooms. She hugs everybody. She's just this light, bright spirit in my life and in other people's lives. And it's only because of you and God. That's the only reason. You know, today I do the footwork and I leave the rest up to God. And like I was telling Vinny before this meeting, everything always works out. Everything always works out. There's not a whole lot of fear in my life today. There's moments that are uncomfortable, but from where I come from, it's like, whatever. Whatever. You know, this is a moment, it'll pass. I highly believe in, okay, my feelings may be crazy right this second, but they're going to feel different in an hour, tomorrow, and I'm going to have a new perspective. It's all about perspective today. Today, the glass is half full, you know, and so there it is there. I'm glad I'm here tonight with you guys. I'm going to go to the convention now and go get my groove on, but it was a pleasure being of service. Thank you. Very good.